WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, C. Everett Koop looks back on his controversial tenure as the Reagan administration's Surgeon General. In his new memoir, he says the administration chose him because they thought he would promote their social agenda. But his positions relating to AIDS and abortion surprised and alienated many of his conservative allies. Remember the TV series Kung Fu? Well, actor David Carradine has written a new book, which is both about his starring role in the series and the history of the martial art. We'll talk about some of his fights on and off camera. And TV critic David Bianculli takes a first look at the new TV season. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The General Counsel of the Federal Reserve Board testified today that former government officials received loans from the Washington, D.C. bank illegally controlled by the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. The disclosure came as top officials of the Fed tried to defend what House Banking Committee Chairman Henry Gonzalez described as its abysmal performance in the BCCI scandal. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Asked whether former government officials had received loans on favorable terms or any loans at all, Virgil Mattingly, the top lawyer for the Fed, said yes, but he said, from what we know now, it's a very limited situation. He would not say whether any impropriety was involved. Since the scandal broke last summer, there have been rumors that either BCCI itself or its Washington bank, First American, were bribing U.S. government officials, but there's been no evidence. Mattingly specifically said that no current government officials had received loans and that investigation is continuing. Earlier, Mattingly and other top officials defended the Fed's role as the best that could have been done under the circumstances. Gerald Corrigan, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, said, in retrospect, there were things that could have been done better, but that would have only made a few months' difference at most. The few members of the banking committee present were largely skeptical, saying the Fed could have started unraveling the scandal years earlier. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
The Palestine Liberation Organization has denied it's behind a commando attack earlier today in South Lebanon. A Swedish member of the United Nations peacekeeping force was killed in the incident. One of the commandos was also killed, and five UN soldiers were injured in a shootout with Israeli soldiers and the Israeli-backed Lebanese militia. Alfred Hermida reports from Tunis.
A senior PLO spokesman, Bassam Abu Sharif, said the commandos who carried out the operation were in no way connected with the PLO. He said the Israeli-backed Lebanese militia were responsible for the deaths and said they were now trying to cover up the incident by blaming the PLO. Sources close to the PLO says the operation looks like the work of Abu Abbas, the leader of a radical group affiliated to the PLO. It was this group that carried out a similar attack on a beach in Israel in May last year. The PLO's failure to condemn the attack led the U.S. to freeze its contact with the organization. Though Abu Abbas is a member of the PLO's executive committee, he is out of favor with the leadership. And there have been reports that he may be forced out when the PLO's parliament in exile, the Palestine National Council, meets in Algiers in 10 days' time. For National Public Radio, this is Alfred Hermida in Tunis.
Prices fell today on Wall Street despite the Federal Reserve's move to lower interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 2,985.69. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 167 million shares. This is NPR News. Major banks began lowering their prime interest rates by half a percentage point today in response to action by the Federal Reserve Board. The prime rate is used to calculate bank loans for businesses and also sets the standard for many kinds of consumer loans. Leading banks reduced their prime rate to 8% after the Federal Reserve announced that it's dropping its discount rate from 5.5% to 5%. The central bank confirmed later that it's taken steps to reduce the federal funds rate, the interest that banks charge one another for overnight loans. The Fed said its action was taken in light of the slowness of the recovery and a reduction in the pressures that lead to inflation. A Palestinian leader returned to the occupied West Bank today after 5 years in exile. The Israeli government allowed him to return home in exchange for the remains of an Israeli soldier who died in Lebanon. The activist predicted that there will soon be a prisoner trade that will include Western hostages. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
Ali Abu Hilal arrived in the country on board the same plane from Vienna, which brought back the remains of Amir Assad, the Israeli soldier captured in Lebanon 8 years ago. The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine surrendered his remains in exchange for Abu Hilal's return, which was the first time an exiled Palestinian had been allowed back into the country. Speaking from his home near Jerusalem, Abu Hilal would not give details about any deal, but said it was likely to include Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners held in Israel and South Lebanon. While Abu Hilal was returning home, Samir Assad was going to his final resting place in his Galilee village of Beit Shan. The Israeli sergeant belonged to the Arab Druze community, whose members serve in the Israeli army. Thousands of mourners attended the military funeral, which included a 21-gun salute. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
A jury has been seated in the drug and racketeering trial of deposed Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. The panel consists of 9 women and 3 men. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, C. Everett Koop, was the Reagan administration's Surgeon General. In Dr. Koop's new memoir, he writes about his behind-the-scenes conflicts with the Reagan administration on abortion, AIDS, and smoking. Koop became the Surgeon General as he was preparing to retire from Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, where he was the chief surgeon. In hindsight, writes Koop, it is clear the Reagan people saw the Surgeon General's job primarily as a means of advocating their social agenda, especially pro-life and family issues. They knew Koop was an evangelical Christian and an ardent opponent of abortion. But Koop proved to be an independent thinker. His advocacy of sex education and condoms to stop the spread of AIDS alienated many of the conservatives who had first supported him, but it made allies of some liberals who had been his opponents. Koop told me he realized early on in his tenure that the Reagan administration expected him to promote its social agenda.
I would be invited to go over to the White House to talk to visitors. Visitors pour into the White House all the time, groups of 10 to 300. But I was always asked to talk about issues having to do with the family life in America, with abortion, with where our concerns were about mounting cost of health care and euthanasia. Never asked to talk about the current health problems in the United States was what I was spending my time doing.
Now, you think that the Reagan administration chose you for Surgeon General because of your position on abortion, but you say you didn't want to use your position to crusade on abortion, even though you were strongly opposed to abortion. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you want to use the position to crusade about abortion?
Well, you know, there's a line in an old hymn that says, "What more can he say?" And that's what I felt. I felt that I had been speaking on this since 1973 and a little before. I had made 3 of a 5 film series with Francis Schaeffer. We had taken that all over the country. And it just seemed to me that I wasn't called to Washington to be just a pro-life Surgeon General. I guess when I went to Dick Schweiker and said to him on the first day I was there, first full day I was there, I said, "I just want you to know that I do not intend to use this job as a pro-life pulpit." He looked both surprised and relieved, and I don't know how to interpret that. But knowing him as I do now, he probably would feel as uncomfortable as I felt to be there for a single purpose. And so it just worked its way out from there.
President Reagan asked you to prepare a report on the adverse mental and physical effects of abortion on women.
He didn't say adverse. He just said the effects, health effects of abortion on women. But the implication was, in the context which he said it, it included the problems of post-abortion syndrome, so-called.
So do you think he already knew what he wanted the conclusion of this report to be?
Well, I know exactly how the report came about. One of his young staffers said, "Mr. President, if you really want to do something about Roe v. Wade, get the Surgeon General to write a health report on the effects of abortion on women. And it'll be so powerful and overwhelming that it will overturn Roe v. Wade." Well, I can't believe President Reagan, politician he was that naive. And I rather suspect, as I think I said in my book, that the president was throwing a bone to the pro-life people. I was the bone.
So what did you tell the president?
Well, another interesting thing I think that people will find in this book, that presidents talk to you through the press. I never had one word with the president before or after this whole affair on abortion. he said it. It was reported in the press. And then, of course, his staff talked to my staff, and my staff told me what my marching orders were. And so I set out to do exactly what he wanted. And I found that there were 225 papers written on the health effects of abortion mentally. We all knew that if you do a certain number of abortions, there'll be a certain number of physical problems. There'll be a few deaths. There'll be a few cases of perforated uterus that are recovered. But not many studies have been done on long-term things such as sterility, because it's very hard to say. If a woman has an abortion in 1980 and is sterile in 1982, you might like to say it was abortion, but you can't prove it. See, that was my whole problem. I was not about to say anything in a report that bore the imprimatur of the Surgeon General. And it's important that you understand that I said title and not my name, because I could never have accomplished what I wanted to and what I did in Washington if I hadn't been preceded by a bunch of people who didn't make fools of themselves. And so I was not about to do that over the issue of abortion. I decided, after reading these papers and working with my staff, that it's practically impossible to write a design for an experiment on this subject without bias. So after pursuing this matter and being convinced in my own mind, and knowing how the pro-life people had pushed the president into this kind of a decision, I wrote him a letter. I worded it very, very carefully, and what I said was that there was no evidence either way about the health effects of abortion on women that I could defend scientifically or statistically. Now, the bombshell was that when that was reported by one of the wire services and picked up by the networks, that's not what was said. It said Dr. Koop could find no ill effects of abortion on women. I didn't say that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, who has just written his memoirs called Koop. You say at a certain point you started to have second thoughts about a lot of people in the anti-abortion movement, and you started to become disturbed by a lack of integrity and an absence of scholarship in pro-life publications.
Mm-hmm. On both sides, really.
On both sides.
Yeah, both sides.
I'm wondering, from the perspective of where you stand now, if you have any reservations of about the books or film that you did on abortion, if there's anything that you would like to change in that. And I guess what I'm thinking of specifically, and forgive me if I don't get this right because the film was a long time ago, but I vaguely remember there was a scene in the documentary that you did about abortion where there's hundreds of dolls.
A thousand dolls.
Mm-hmm. With their limbs kind of torn off, yes?
No, you're getting two things mixed up.
Okay.
I'll tell you what they were.
Help me out.
Well, we wanted to make one point about the number mm-hmm. of abortions. So we had 1,000 dolls, and they were out on the Dead Sea because they float so much above the water. They let their lion on a lake. And we said that each one of these dolls, 1,000 of them, represent a tremendous number, another 1,000 babies who have been aborted last year, because we had 1 million abortions a year in those days. And the other one that you're thinking about, I was trying to get across the idea that defective babies now are looked upon only for the defect you can see and not for the innovative, creative, loved, and loving person he or she could become. And what I had were dolls coming down an assembly line with an inspector throwing away anyone that had something missing, like a leg or an arm. It was to make a point. It's kind of a living cartoon. So I haven't changed my mind at all about those things.
The doll Holocaust scene, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. on the Dead Sea was criticized by a lot of people for being a kind of sensationalist
sure.
way.
Sure, I was trying to make it sensational. I wanted people to know. I mean, we don't understand numbers. When someone says 1 million babies were aborted last year, I don't just think of the 1 million fetuses that were dropped in buckets. I think of the 1 million families that had to go through this unbelievable, painful decision, no matter what it is. 16-year-old girl in school, 14-year-old girl in school, pregnant, not wishing to be, and not planning to be. No matter what course she takes, it disrupts her life forever. It disrupts the family. It disrupts the extended family, the community, the church, everybody. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so interested in having the numbers of abortions reduced, and why I think both sides could get together, come to some kind of a political compromise that would not be a moral compromise. And the whole point of that is that a large segment of the pro-life movement equates contraception with abortion, and they are quite different. And when you set up a principle and say, we're talking about pregnancy, we will not let you prevent it, and we will not let you get rid of it after it's happened, you have put a segment of women into an unbelievable bind.
Former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is the former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, and he's just written his memoirs. One of the subjects you spend a lot of time on in your memoirs is AIDS and how you tried to handle that and how the Reagan administration handled it. This is an area where, like with abortion, you surprised some people, made new friends, made enemies out of some old friends. You say that you weren't allowed to speak publicly about AIDS in your position of Surgeon General until Reagan's second term. What were the restraints and how were they imposed on you?
I don't really understand it, even to this day. It wasn't that I was... You have to understand how it was presented to me. These are the things you're covering now. We'll take care of these. So that means if you're doing that, we're doing this, you're not doing AIDS. The way I found out about it was that when I would go to an interview like this, someone from the Public Affairs Department would go ahead of me and say, don't ask Dr. Koop any questions about AIDS. Now, I don't know whether they thought I was going to have a tantrum or go into shrieking hysterics about it or try to impose a morality that might not be that of the television station or the government. I don't know. But it all came to a happy conclusion. And I look back on it and say without any question, if I had been asked to be the spokesperson about AIDS in the very beginning, mm-hmm. I would never have had the impact I had when I came. So that by going through that period from 81 to 85 and saying, what in the world is going on? And then suddenly having someone saying, I'll tell you what's going on, I'd had a much better impact than if I had been a constant voice during those years.
Well, you're of the opinion, I think, that the Reagan administration really didn't want AIDS addressed at all early on. They saw the Just Say No campaign against drugs as a win-win situation, you say, but speaking about AIDS was a no-win,
situation. Right.
Why was that a no-win situation?
Well, I think, again, you have to recognize constituencies. And although the conservative wing of the Republican Party is not large, it does have influence, and it has elected presidents, and it makes itself known very quickly when something comes up. The controversy right now about whether or not people coming into this country should be HIV positive or negative is being fought largely as a political battle behind the scenes by conservatives. I can't really believe that Mr. Bush in his heart believes that that's what you ought to do, because I'm the one that taught Mr. Bush much of what he knows about AIDS. So I know he has a very thorough understanding of it. And to arrive on the scene with a piece of paper that says, look, I'm HIV negative, let me in your country, it's without value unless you lived with that person every minute for the past 6 months, because whatever his sexual behavior was, his ability to use and abuse drugs, he might be at the moment infected, more infectious than he ever will be again in his life. But you have the false premise that he's got a piece of paper that says he's okay.
Well, you say that a lot of Reagan officials were biased against homosexuals and they tried to stir up hostility toward AIDS victims. I'd like to hear some examples from what you saw and heard behind the scenes of that.
Well, I give one in the book where I was invited to lunch by a senator. And some of these people I've been talking about were there. The people they brought with them were people who despise homosexuals. I think I like to interrupt and say we need a new word in our language, because to describe people like that as homophobes is incorrect. These people are not afraid of homosexuals. They hate them. And On the occasion I'm talking about, the senator, who was the host, found out who the guest would be, and he didn't even come to the luncheon, but sent one of his aides. And I sat there and heard these diatribes, which were primarily against homosexuality rather than the disease we're talking about. And I just faced them down with everything that they said with scientific fact. They all shut up and they all went home. Those same people eventually found their way right into the Domestic Policy Council of the White House and told them all the same things. And there's an occasion when I was present at a task force of AIDS interested people, and one of the White House representatives said, "How do we know that you're right and these other people who tell us it comes from toilet seats are wrong? Maybe we ought to try it their way." From a government official sitting in a domestic policy office of the White House, it's almost inconceivable.
I'm wondering if your religious views predisposed you against homosexuals.
Let me give you a funny answer.
Yeah.
If I don't tell you, it doesn't really matter, because
that's an interesting answer.
I didn't ever let my religious views in any way influence what I said as a public servant to you. And on the contrary, having taken an oath to uphold the Constitution and do a lot of other things, including my job, which was to inform the public, the first thing that I did was to make it very clear how AIDS was really transmitted, how it was not transmitted. And then I followed up by saying that I was the Surgeon General of all the people, and not just the people whose lifestyles pleased some members of Congress, and also said we were fighting the disease and not the people who had it. So I staked out my claim pretty carefully, and I adhered to that. But I followed it up when I found that many religious broadcasts in this country were indeed fomenting this idea that it's homosexuals that we must be afraid of, not the disease they have, I went to the National Religious Broadcasters, representing practically everybody on television or radio in this land, and I said, if you are one who believes on the basis of your religion that homosexuality and homosexual behavior is a sin, then I know that the same source that told you that has told you to separate the sin from the sinner. So you ought to go out and take care of a patient with AIDS as a sick person. You don't ask him how he got his disease or what his personality was. You just take care of his problem.
You released the Surgeon General's report on AIDS on October 22nd of 1986. Mm-hmm. You emphasized the importance of abstinence and monogamy, but you also emphasized sex education. Now, in the report, you wrote, "Most Americans are opposed to homosexuality, promiscuity of any kind, and prostitution." You were asked to revise that.
I was asked by a member of the White House staff to change that to all.
To all Americans oppose homosexuality, promiscuity,
and
prostitution.
I said, "I can't." He said, "Why not?" He said, "Because all Americans aren't. Even if there are 10 people who are pimps and they're making their living on prostitution, that's not all people. So I can't say, because it's wrong."
Was it kind of embarrassing for you to be in the position of having to talk about sex education and sexual acts and the use of condoms? I think a lot of people are not used to speaking about these kinds of things in public, and you were in the position of trying to help Americans come up with language that they could be comfortable using in public.
Mm-hmm. Well, I used to preface some of the things that I said in those days by, "Ladies and gentlemen, it is not easy for this elderly gentleman, married for more than 50 years with 7 grandchildren, to talk to you about a word that you've kept in the closet for all of your life. But we are dealing with people who will not be abstinent, who will not be mutually faithfully monogamous, and if they persist in their behavior, we have to tell them to protect themselves. That is my job as your Surgeon General. Now, the only thing we have to offer as protection is a condom. But I hasten to add, anybody who uses it, it is not 100% safe. But as a rubber gadget, it's more safe than the people that use it, at least more reliable."
The term exchange of bodily fluids
is such rubbish. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, I don't know how you exchange bodily fluids with the possible exception of a very wet kiss.
So did you advocate the use of that term? I can't remember.
I never used it.
You never used
Never used it. Mm-mm. There's certain things that I know I never said. That's one of them.
Because you thought it was a...
But it's not an exchange, you know.
It was always very vague, too. What?
Yeah, that's
what
right.
Do we mean by that?
There was a people who would not be willing to use the word semen. That's all that was. And they didn't have to say it any other way. They didn't say deposit, because then that let women off the hook, because they weren't the depositors, you see.
What's your assessment of the damage that might have been caused by the Reagan administration having waited so long, having muzzled you in speaking about AIDS?
It's an imponderable.
Yeah.
But I do say, when I'm talking about this publicly, reviewing the history of AIDS, say that in the early political days, when everybody was fighting a political agenda instead of a health agenda, mm-hmm. that valuable time was lost and lives were lost. But I have no idea of knowing how many.
Do you think that the Bush administration is still fighting a political agenda instead of a health agenda?
I think Mr. Bush is still plagued by the conservatives who beat on him any time an issue comes up that could be loosened a little bit. Like, it's absolutely ridiculous for this country to close its doors to AIDS scientists and have to cancel next year's international meeting on AIDS and have it shipped from Boston to someplace in Central Europe. That's not leadership.
I think one of the dilemmas you had to wrestle with through your years as Surgeon General is how does someone in a position like yours deal with what their own religion tells them when they are also in a leadership position in a pluralistic society where not everybody shares the same religious views? So what were some of the ways you resolved that for yourself?
Well, let me put it very bluntly. My religion, my ethics, my morals are probably what you approve of most in me, even though you don't know it. Because Washington is composed of substance and process. Now, the substance is what I did, and that could be called my conclusions. You may not have liked my conclusions, but if you watch the process that I used to get there, it was the outworking of my ethics and my morals, which said, I have to be honest, I have to do this with integrity. I am a public servant. I am not entitled to the luxury of choosing my clientele.
I found your memoirs to be pretty candid. On the other hand, I don't know what it is that you're not telling us. Is there a lot that you're still holding back for reasons of diplomacy or for protecting people who you respect, even though you disagree with the way they handled something?
No, I don't think so. I went through that book to be very careful that I didn't let any personal feelings I have about somebody inadvertently bias what I said about them. That's not what the book is for. I don't think anything is to be gained by that. I think I got across what I wanted to get across, and that was the answer most people ask me, how did you do it?
Well, thank you very much for talking with
Pleasure.
Us. My guest has been Dr. C. Everett Koop, former Surgeon General during the Reagan administration. He's written his memoirs. The book is called Koop, The Memoirs of America's Family Doctor. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. for 3 years in the early 1970s, actor David Carradine starred in the TV series Kung Fu. That role brought Carradine fame, not to mention lots of injuries. Coming up, David Carradine tells us how that role got him challenged in fights, in trouble with the FCC, and led him to write his new book. Also for Couch Potatoes Everywhere, it's the big event of the year, the start of the fall TV season. TV critic David Bianculli has a preview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Nomination hearings for Judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court continue today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. NPR's Mara Liasson reports that the atmosphere surrounding today's hearing was less confrontational.
So far, there is no indication that Thomas's approval by the committee is anything but assured. Today, Democrats were less confrontational with Thomas. One Democrat, Howell Heflin of Alabama, even led Thomas back to the kind of discussion he and his White House handlers enjoy the best, Thomas's own personal story. Heflin asked Thomas to describe his participation in civil rights protests and talk about how he heard about the assassination of Martin Luther King. Then Heflin spoke positively about the nominee, leading some observers to predict Heflin was preparing a public defense for a yes vote. Thomas will return to finish his testimony before the committee on Monday. Then groups both opposed to and supportive of Thomas will have their chance to testify. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A lobbying effort by President Bush for his nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court and the CIA failed to work this afternoon. The White House bought satellite time to send up 3 minutes of presidential comments in support of his two nominees, thus bypassing news editors in Washington. But in the first effort, only static and garble were heard, and in the second, a Canadian news conference was picked up. Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater had said earlier that the satellite speech would cost taxpayers about $5,000. In Miami, a jury has been chosen to try Manuel Noriega on drug conspiracy charges. The case against the former Panamanian leader is set to begin Monday morning with opening arguments by U.S. government prosecutors. NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports from Miami.
After a week of rigorous screening by government and defense attorneys, a jury was finally sworn in late this afternoon to a ripple of applause from the public gallery. The 12 who will judge General Noriega are largely middle class and predominantly female. There are 9 women jurors and 3 men. 8 of them are black, 2 are Hispanic and 2 white. 6 alternate jurors were also selected to hear the case and to sit in for any jurors who drop out during a trial that is sure to last several months. 4 of them are also black, the other 2 Hispanic. District Judge William Hoover advised the jury, "You are now embarking on a very important project." He warned them not to discuss the case with anyone, not family, not even each other. They'll take their seats at 9:30 Monday morning when the long-awaited trial begins. In Miami, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 22 points to close at 2,988.69. This is NPR News. In Yugoslavia, Croatian forces have lost a key town to Serbian guerrillas. Victories by the Serbian forces mean that they have cut the breakaway republic into 3 parts and occupied more than 1/3 of Croatian territory. According to radio reports, the federal president plans to call in the UN to send in a peacekeeping force. He also once again accused the federal army with carrying out a military coup. Army officials have denied charges that the Federal Army has been aiding Serbian forces. The first working session of the Peace Conference on Yugoslavia ended today in the Netherlands, with Lord Carrington, chairman of the conference, announcing that he will travel to Yugoslavia on Monday. NPR's John Itzty reports.
Lord Carrington stressed the difficulty of conducting negotiations while the fighting continues between Serbs and Croats, but he said the violence is inextricably linked with the political situation, and he said he will work at solving the political puzzle during his trip to Yugoslavia next week.
I would seek in my conversations with the two presidents to explore such common ground as there is to find whether or not it's possible to devise something other than the present Yugoslavia.
Lord Carrington suggested a looser confederation of republics than the current Yugoslavia. The chairman of the peace conference also suggested that the European community send more observers to the area, but he said he thought it was unlikely that the EC would send an armed force to put down the violence, as some have suggested it should. I'm John Idstey in London.
In another effort to get the U.S. economy moving again, the Federal Reserve has announced that it's cutting its discount interest rate to 5% from 5.5%. Other rates are now expected to go down, making it easier to borrow money for such items as new cars and new homes. The Fed last changed the discount rate April 30th. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Actor David Carradine is the son of the actor John Carradine and half-brother of actors Robert and Keith. The Carradine brothers played outlaws in The Long Riders. David played Woody Guthrie in Bound for Glory. But the role that brought David Carradine the most popular recognition was on TV in the series Kung Fu. He played Kane, a half-Chinese, half-American who was brought up in China in a Shaolin monastery where he learned Kung Fu as part of his training. The series followed Kane's adventures as he wandered through the American West using kung fu on bad guys and passing on ancient wisdom. The series first ran in the early 70s. More recently, you may have seen Carradine on TV marketing his new line of kung fu and tai chi instructional videos, which he promises will focus your mind and take inches off your waist. Carradine also has a new book called The Spirit of Shaolin, which is both about the kung fu TV series and the history of the martial art. Carradine writes, "I am no master of kung fu, nor a disciple." But he says he wrote the book because he was asked to by the kung fu master who used to choreograph the fight scenes in the TV series. I asked Carradine what role kung fu has played in his own life off camera.
Well, it's had certainly an effect on me. It's not always easy to say exactly what, but it's changed my road for sure. And since it's not over yet, I can't tell you where the path is going to lead, but it is, it's made me concentrate on things that maybe I wouldn't have in the first place. You know, I began as a Shakespearean actor, and the directions I thought I would go in turn out not to be the directions I am going in, but I think that's true of anybody's life.
You spend part of your new book talking about things that happened behind the scenes in the TV series Kung Fu. I was really surprised to read that Bruce Lee was up for the role. I think that might have been in the original movie. I can't remember if it was the movie or the TV series. But what's the story there, and how did you end up getting the role over Bruce Lee?
Well, I'm not sure I got it over him. I think I just got it instead of him. That was certainly, as was proven later by Bruce, it was a reasonable idea for him. But I think it just wasn't his destiny. His destiny lay someplace else. But the way I got the role was I had done a play on Broadway called The Royal Hunt of the Sun, where I played the Emperor of the Incas. And Jerry Thorpe, who was the real master of the Kung Fu series, the person who pretty much created it and caused it to succeed, he'd seen that play, and he came looking for me. And I couldn't very well turn down a part that good.
Did they do anything to try to make you look part Chinese?
Yeah, they put a little tiny corner at the inside of my eyes that made my eyes look slightly more Oriental, and they painted me yellow.
Oh, really?
And also, I bent my legs a little bit most of the time, so I didn't look so tall.
How tall are you?
I'm 6'2".
Uh-huh. When Kung Fu was first on, I was taking taekwondo lessons. Taekwondo is a Korean form of karate. And in our Monday class, our teacher would always make some comment about the previous episode of Kung Fu, about how the fights were just so improbable that you wouldn't be able to stay alive through one of those fights. You'd have so many broken limbs, you wouldn't be able to function and come back for more. I'm wondering what you think.
Well, you know, right in front of you, I wouldn't want to tell you that your master doesn't necessarily know what he's talking about. But we were looking for realism. We were looking to more illustrate the possibilities of the various forms of kung fu than we were actually trying to just simply show you a fight. I mean, you might say, on the other hand, you know, this is a form of entertainment, that the fights were closer to the fights that you see in, say, West Side Story than what you would see in an arena. But I think, you know, the modern things that you see now with Van Damme and those people are even more so in that way, that one of those punches would, you know, crack your clavicle or break your skull or something like that, knock all your teeth out. But I really think, really, in Kung Fu, that we stressed the softness more than we stressed anything else. I think Bruce Lee's version of it, or, you know, these modern guys, is much more unbelievable in terms of people getting hurt. You know, we basically tried to show that Kwai Chan Kang was not trying to hurt people. He was just trying to stop the violence. A lot of that had to do with the fact that the FCC said that they didn't want me to kill people. And we had to make some kind of adjustment.
Yeah, let me bring up here something I found really interesting, that the FCC used to limit the number of minutes per show that you could fight. And they objected to you killing people on the show, too?
Yeah. See, now, we didn't really have an attitude ourselves. We just thought we were doing a good show. And we hated the fact that we'd do these great fights, and then the FCC would say, well, you got to cut this out and cut that out and all that. And some of the things that are the absolute identifying characteristics of the show were produced as a result of these things. For instance, the slow motion created a softer look, and the FCC would be more happy about it. And that's also why we went to so many training sequences, because that way we could do the moves, and it would not be thought of as violent.
Actor David Carradine is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor David Carradine is my guest. He's written a new book about kung fu, both the TV series and the martial art. You not only did the kung fu TV series, but you did a lot of films in which you performed martial arts. I'm wondering if over the years a lot of people have come up to you on the street and tried to pick a fight with you just to test themselves against your skills.
Well, a few, yeah. That's happened. I've never gotten any real trouble, but there were certainly some people that tried to give me some. One of the convenient things about Kung Fu mastery is that real Kung Fu masters are very unlikely to try to pick a fight with you. It's usually punks, more or less. But there were a couple of times when the numbers were really kind of large. You know, if you got 9 rednecks walking across the street to pick a fight with you, that does kind of get formidable.
So tell me what happened in that instance and what you did.
Well, you get out of it any way you can. You know, the first rule when faced with a superior opponent is run away. And I did some of that. And sometimes I was able to make a couple of moves that were impressive enough so that people backed off. And sometimes I was able to just change it from a confrontation to something like an autograph session.
You write that the reason why you were able to perform the kung fu parts on TV so well was that you loved dance and you had the body and the flexibility to really do this kind of stuff. You loved dance as a child, but you say your father, the actor John Carradine, wouldn't let you take dance classes. Why not? What kind of problem did he have with dance?
Well, the way he put it was, he said, "No son of mine will make his living with his feet." And that just shows you that destiny is inescapable, because what I ended up doing instead of tapping around was kicking people.
So did you sneak in dance lessons behind his back?
More or less, yes.
What kind?
Well, I studied ballet and I studied tap and I studied a lot of ethnic forms as well.
How close did you get to performing that kind of dance, any of those kinds?
I performed it a lot.
musicals or?
Yeah, musicals and ballet and you know, just, well, I had a band for a long time where I performed on stage, and one of the numbers was that I would tap dance down into the audience and around and on tables and stuff like that.
Did seeing the example of your father and his acting career make you want to act, or did that give you reservations about becoming an actor?
Both. I had reservations. I saw how much pain is involved and how much artifice and how much of it, how much of the business part of it I would probably never understand, as I saw my father going through these problems. Also, part of the reason why I went into an acting career was to finish the job he'd started, because he always felt he didn't go as far as he could. And as a matter of fact, it was kind of a revenge motif that started me out in it. I wanted to get even with these guys for not giving my father what he wanted. And to a certain extent, I guess I've accomplished that, and to a certain extent, I haven't. But then, you know, that's part of the story we were always trying to tell, was that, you know, revenge doesn't work. It belongs to the Lord.
Did that give you an attitude when you started acting, you know, an attitude that maybe got in the way?
Yeah. I certainly spent a lot of time with a chip on my shoulder, and I may have not completely gotten rid of it, actually, though I'm more philosophical about it. And that's, you know, you asked me long time back in this interview, what Kung Fu did for me aside from the acting. And that's one of the things. I do have a more philosophical attitude about my own problems and about the injustice that happens in this industry. And I'm more conversant now. I mean, I can sit around and talk about it and just try to solve problems rather than butting heads, which I probably, now that I think of it, I did a lot of that at the beginning, butting heads, which doesn't really do any good, you know?
Well, if one motivation in starting your acting career was revenge for your father not having always gotten what he wanted and what he deserved, do you feel that you've gotten in your acting career what you've wanted and what you think you're worthy of?
No, I figured that when my son gets to be about 35 years old, that he'll start taking revenge on the problems I had. That's sort of a joke. No, I really don't think that that is relevant anymore. That was something, maybe you might say a childish idea that I had.
I've always enjoyed your acting and, you know, wish that I was seeing you in more movies now.
Well, I guess you're not going to my movies then, because I made 10 last year, and I made, I think, 11 the year before that. I got an award about a little over a year ago, I think it was, for being the most working actor in the universe.
You're kidding, really?
Yeah, I did.
What are the 10 movies you made last year?
I can't remember.
You can't remember the movies you made?
No. I really can't. If I had my resume in front of me, I could pull them out.
Are a lot of these like international productions?
Some of them are. I'm doing just about everything. You know, I do, well, I will do a big Hollywood movie, and I'll do a couple of small independent films, and I'll do something that's sort of an art film, like say a film noir kind of thing. And then I'll do a movie for television. And I'll do even a TV segment once in a while. Usually I do that because somebody I know who's doing a series, it would be fun to work with them. And I'm also, you know, active on stage. I'm about to open in a play here called Don Juan in Hell. You probably know about that play, don't you?
Yeah, I'm trying to place it. I know the title.
Well, George Bernard Shaw, he wrote a play called Man and Superman. And Don Juan in Hell is a part of it that is never done with the play, because if they did the whole thing, it'd be like a 5-hour play.
Right.
So they put it in two pieces. And I'm playing the devil, which will be a lot of fun. And Ricardo Montalban is playing Don Juan, and he comes to hell, and we have a long discussion, basically, about what's really going on in the world. We're going to do it here in Los Angeles, and then take it on tour, and the ideas will end up in New York.
I read all these things about the people I'm interviewing, and I never know what's true and what's not. But I read somewhere that you shot yourself accidentally with a Colt 45 while shooting a scene in
sure
a film.
Sure
did. Was it? Did you shoot yourself with a blank or with an actual bullet?
No, you don't use actual bullets in movies unless you're completely insane.
Right.
Which, by the way, certain people are.
Right.
Henry Hathaway did a picture once, a war movie, in which he wanted to have tracer bullets. But by and large, you don't do that. But point-blank range, a blank can actually kill you. It didn't kill me. I have a tough groin.
Ooh.
I mean, I was shot in the groin. But it did ruin a perfectly good tattoo.
Oh, jeez. So you have a scar in the middle of the tattoo?
The butterfly now has a rather ragged wing. Let's put it that way.
Well, I can say is if you shot yourself in the groin and that tattoo was the worst of the problems, you're really lucky. How do you do scenes now with guns differently than you did that time you were hurt? Was there a lesson that you learned about handling a gun?
Well, I've always been pretty good at handling a gun. The problem was we were in a real hurry. And the way I was using the guns, I had to repeat what I'd done in an earlier scene, and it was dangerous. We all knew it was dangerous. You take a lot of chances in movies. Look, in these kung fu movies, I have broken or dislocated virtually every finger and every toe that I have. I've crushed my ribs. I've smashed my shoulder. I've destroyed a ligament in the knee. I could go on. Acting is a dangerous profession. And when you consider I've made 68 features, plus all the television and everything, you just got to expect that I'm going to hurt myself now and then. It's sort of like being a football player or something.
Well, David Carradine, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, hey, I want to thank you a lot for allowing me to.
Actor David Carradine, he's written a new book called The Spirit of Shaolin. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert. What do you have?
Hi, Terry. We'll have a report on the confirmation hearings of Judge Clarence Thomas. Our correspondent Nina Totenberg says that a lot of the senators are hearing from Southern Democrats in the Senate who say, there's no sentiment to vote against Thomas. In fact, there's a lot for him in our state. So, you know, let's not go so hard that you make it necessary to vote against. So it's been a pretty positive day for Judge Thomas. That we'll also be hearing about the 20th anniversary of the uprising at Attica Prison in New York State and the 50th anniversary of the first gold record ever. You know what it was?
What?
Chattanooga Choo Choo.
By who?
Glenn Miller.
Oh, his version. All right, sure. Of course. Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For TV fans, it's the big event of the year, the start of the fall TV season. Some of the new shows have already premiered. Others are about to debut. There are more new shows this season than ever before, 27 in all. TV critic David Bianculli has seen virtually all of them, except for the ones that aren't ready yet. Here's his first look.
What do I think about this new fall season? Not much. Here's a list of the new fall shows that are so good that you can't miss them, gotta watch them, wanna collect them. Get the idea? 2 years ago, when Twin Peaks premiered and got everybody excited about TV again, one of the network executives said that Tried and True is dead and buried. Well, I'm sorry to report that based on this year's fall schedule, Tried and True is alive and, well, let's just say it's alive. The theme this year seems to be bland ambition. The majority of the shows and a lot of the stars seem to date from the 70s, one heck of a way to begin the 90s. It's not that the schedule is hit and miss this year. It's miss and miss and miss and miss, and you can miss almost all of it without missing much. There is a cream to this crop, though. Erie, Indiana, which premieres Sunday on NBC, is a stylish sitcom that flips the old Addams Family formula. Instead of one strange family moving into normal suburbia, Erie, Indiana, that's eerie as in creepy, is about normal kids keeping tabs on their very strange neighbors. Joe Dante directed the pilot, which begins like this.
Hi. My name is Marshall Teller. And this is my best friend, Simon Holmes.
Hi.
Actually, he's my only friend since I moved here from New Jersey. He's also the only person who believes me about my new hometown, Erie, Indiana.
People think we're weird.
Better weird than dead.
Item. Bigfoot eats out of our trash.
We got footprints.
Item. The cornfield behind my house is the number one landing site for UFOs in the Northern Hemisphere. We got pictures. Item. After he died, Elvis had his mail forwarded to a house on my street. We got junk mail. Still don't believe us. You will. Ready, Simon? Ready? I was born for this.
It's good and it's unusual, and I like it a lot. My other favorite new series, at least of the ones I've seen so far, is Sibs, a comedy about three sisters that begins Tuesday on ABC. Marsha Mason, Margaret Cullen, and Jamie Gertz play the siblings, and all three are very funny. As are Alex Rocco as Mason's husband, and Dan Castellaneta as her boss. Castellaneta, like executive producers James L. Brooks, Sam Simon, and Heidi Perlman, worked together on The Tracy Ullman Show, and Sibs has that same wonderful sort of character humor. As a taste, here's a scene where Mason confronts her boss.
I just quit. I don't have to listen to your paranoid delusions anymore. I can even tell you you're nuts. Warren!
What?
You're nuts!
Oh, really? Oh, please. Let's deal with the real reason why you're quitting.
Warren, what are you talking about?
She said coyly. Okay. A great majority of the clients have been calling ever since my uncle's death, saying they don't want me, a CPA, to handle their accounts. They want you, a bookkeeper.
Really? Oh, my God. I don't know what to say. The only thing that comes to mind is, ha ha!
No one knows me. No one knows the real Warren Morris. They like you because you don't just do their books, do you? No, you...
act like a human being?
So you admit it.
What else is worth watching? NBC's Man of the People because James Garner is so charming. And because it's a sitcom without a laugh track. Reasonable Doubts, because Marlee Matlin and Mark Harmon work so well together. But aside from the uniqueness of a deaf character as a series star, it's a standard Law & Order, Opposites Attract kind of TV show. And maybe there are a few other good shows to come, and I'll review them in the weeks to come. Finally, what to miss? That's easy. Avoid at all costs The Torkelsons, The Adventures of Mark and Brian, and P.S. I Love You. P.S. I hate this season. So far, anyway.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is directed by Chris Spurgeon. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If when you think of Los Angeles, you think of Hollywood and cult groups, then your idea of the city may be outdated. On the next Fresh Air, writer David Reif tells us how immigration is transforming Los Angeles. His new book is called Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.